This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice from the New York Times opinion section. I'm Katie Kingsbury. In our last episode, you heard the board interview former Vice President Joe Biden. In this episode, you'll hear what we had to say after Mr. Biden left the boardroom. If you haven't heard the interview, go back and listen to that first. Joining me today to talk about Mr. Biden's visit and reproductive health care and gender in the 2020 election is board member Lauren Kelly.
I'm Lauren Kelly. I cover women and reproductive rights for the editorial board.
First, let's listen to the board's reaction after the Biden interview.
I was looking for the candidate that's been sort of portrayed in the media as, like, you know, not either not with it or lost a considerable amount or sort of discombobulated or something. But he didn't strike me like that at all.
I agree. I totally agree.
I was really comforted by the Joe Biden that showed up there.
Yeah. I thought he was pretty much on his game.
I thought he was honest. Like, he didn't wander. He didn't ramble. He wasn't like, I mean, he's all there.
Yeah.
Or he was. In the second half. When he started talking about foreign policy, particularly, he's
head and shoulders above the rest on foreign policy.
Absolutely.
Whether
yeah.
you agree with him or not, he's head and shoulders.
He's an incredibly impressive, skilled, compassionate, talented retail politician, and you can understand why he has had such staying power. I guess the question is just whether, and this goes to what we didn't really get to, but is it enough for the moment? Is it enough politically? Is it enough to save the middle class? Does he understand? He understands, I think, the political and moral crisis, but does he really understand kind of the world that so many of us are living in? I think what we didn't get to kind of follow up on the millennial issue, but I mean, does he understand the anger?
One thing I would have liked to have followed up, he said at the beginning, you know, he's taken more incoming fire in this campaign than anybody. He hasn't seen the beginning of it. He's got a 50-year record, and wait till he goes up against Trump and $300 million of Republican Oppo research.
I think both of the questions I asked him, his answers were, frankly, nonsense on both of them. His Hyde answer makes no sense at all.
I believe him. I think he accused us of ageism, and I say, like, you know, yeah, I'm ageist. I mean, I absolutely have profound concerns about a 77...
Strike that from the record.
No, I absolutely think it's right to be very concerned about someone who's pushing 80 years old running the largest country in the world.
But that's
the most
not
powerful
ageism.
Country in the world.
That's not ageism.
That's not ageism.
Well, whatever.
I know, whatever you want to call it.
I'm saying I'm concerned about Bernie Sanders. I'm concerned
Why
about
Why is that not
him.
Ageism?
It is. I'm. Yeah, but what's the big deal?
I mean, do you want a baby running?
No, but he agreed that it's fair to raise the question.
Look, these 77, 78-year-olds are the healthiest, most most fit, most cognitively lucid 77, 78-year-olds who've ever lived on the planet. My father's about to turn 80. He's an he's got all his faculties with him. I would never want my father to run the whole, have to run the country. He looked tired. Yes, he looked better than like a doddering old man, but he looked tired. He looked like someone, and this is nothing compared to running the free world. Like, it's just, I'm really concerned that the Democrats are putting their chips in the basket of a near 80-year-olds.
But that can be, I'm not going to die.
Right. That's your pitch. This is the party of the future, and your pitch is I'm not going to die. Like,
you know, I thought the more he talked, the better. I mean, his handicap in the debates was the 30-minute bite. Here, when he could tell his long stories, which I presume he can do better once he's the candidate.
Right.
There was a little of that, like, when you'd bring up the Obama administration, whenever things would kind of get, when he'd get in a corner where he's, well, I'm not the president. And then the other parts of it where it's like, well, look what we did.
He wanted to play it both ways.
Yeah.
He was like, I had presidential power. I'm not the president. I had president. Yeah.
That's a politician's answer.
I know.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So before we get into the interview with Biden, can you lay out for us the current status of reproductive rights in the United States and help us understand what's at stake in this election?
Yeah, this is a precarious moment for reproductive rights. It's probably the most precarious moment since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. You know, over the years, Roe's been chipped away at. There's been a whole heap of anti-abortion bills around the country. And then while that's been happening, there's been this pipeline of conservative judges who are hostile to abortion, who have been sort of fostered by anti-abortion advocates. So when Trump won the election, then when Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement, of course, he had been kind of a swing justice on the Supreme Court. It sort of became clear that those conservatives were really going to finally try and accomplish their goal, which is, of course, ending legal abortion access in America.
How has reproductive rights come into play in the 2020 race so far?
Yeah, so far, Trump has really tried to set the terms of this debate. He keeps using rhetoric, talking about infanticide, conflating abortion with murdering babies. He especially says this when the topic of later abortions comes up. You know, of course, later abortions happen rarely. They generally happen when something has gone terribly and tragically wrong in a pregnancy. But he has really tried to back Democrats into a corner to having to answer for, again, what he calls infanticide incorrectly.
Biden has some baggage around reproductive rights. What were your concerns going into this interview?
Right. So probably his biggest baggage relates to the Hyde Amendment.
Okay, how about we focus on Hyde then?
I can explain Hyde.
Please do.
First of all, everybody's voted for Hyde. Every single person running.
Well, because it's in the spending bill.
I understand. I got it. But they all, this idea, this is such a principle thing.
Well, it's principled. I mean, most of the party has been in favor of overturning Hyde.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I understand that. Look, let me answer the question directly. I thought that when there were reasonable alternatives and funding mechanisms that did not deny women the opportunity to take advantage of their constitutional right under Roe v. Wade as amended by Casey, that in fact it was okay.
You and the vice president kind of get into it over the Hyde Amendment. Can you explain what that is?
In a nutshell, the Hyde Amendment is a federal statute that dates back to 1976, and it says that federal Medicaid dollars cannot be used to pay for abortions, except in a few narrow circumstances. And of course, who relies on Medicaid? Poor women. So that explains why in America today, it is so much harder for a woman without resources or without insurance coverage through work to get an abortion, whereas a woman who has more resources, it's much easier for her to get the exact same procedure. Again, it's been around since 1976, basically almost immediately after Roe v. Wade was decided. And, you know, of course, that made abortion legal across the country. Then the Hyde Amendment came along just a few years later and made abortion inaccessible to millions of those women. So it really stifles the effect of Roe v. Wade. Henry Hyde was a Republican congressman from Illinois, and he really made clear what this was about on the House floor during debate at the time. He said, quote, I would certainly like to prevent, if I could legally, anybody from having an abortion, a rich woman, a middle-class woman, or a poor woman. Unfortunately, he said, the only vehicle available is the Medicaid bill. So basically, poor women it was. And that's what we have today.
And actually, almost every congressperson ends up voting in favor of the Hyde Amendment because it is part of a budget bill. But Vice President Biden has been vocal in his support of the Hyde Amendment in the past, correct?
That's right. So it's really hard to get rid of the Hyde Amendment because it is in that federal spending bill. And, you know, it's a really unappealing situation to be faced with either going to bat to fight the Hyde Amendment or, you know, if you do that, you're going to face a government shutdown. So there's always so much to sort of bicker about in the federal spending bill. And sort of every year that this comes up, it's a problem for Democrats. And they just have not been able to figure out how to strip Hyde from the spending bill. But you're right. Joe Biden had long supported the Hyde Amendment. And, you know, it's interesting. He really evolved over the years on reproductive rights. By the point that he jumped into the 2020 race, I think you could pretty safely say that he was pretty pro-choice. Like, he was supporting most of the pro-choice policies that the other Democrats in the race were supporting. However, the Hyde Amendment was the one big exception to that. He still supported Hyde. That was up until this sort of fateful incident last summer. I think it's probably faded from a lot of people's memories, but there was a sort of crazy couple of days where Joe Biden was at an event in South Carolina, and this woman walks up to him, and she was a volunteer with the ACLU, and she says, "Mr. Vice President, would you commit to abolishing the Hyde Amendment?" And, you know, you can see video of this exchange online. He's looking her right in the eye. He says, clear as day, yes. Saying yes, he would end the Hyde Amendment. And so that was pretty stunning. And of course, immediately there were headlines everywhere like, wow, Joe Biden, he's changed his position on Hyde. That's incredible. But as soon as his campaign saw those headlines, they sort of slammed on the brakes and they were like, wait, no, just kidding. He still supports the Hyde Amendment. So they were sort of caught off guard there. But by that point, there was really no going back. I mean, he just looked so out of step with the rest of the party, and there was so much pressure on him. And so pretty quickly, he sort of looked around at the race and he said, okay, you know what? Yes, if I'm elected president, I will fight to get rid of Hyde. But you can kind of see how it's hard to feel like he's completely committed to that since he sort of stumbled into that position. So I think there's a lot of questions for voters about how committed he really is.
And we should add the context that the vice president has been in favor of the Hyde Amendment due to his Catholic faith, and that has also led him to this evolution that you're describing around reproductive rights.
You know, I think he has grappled with this personally a lot because of his faith. And, you know, he might not be in favor of abortion personally. Like, he might not.
Yeah, like so many Catholics.
Absolutely.
And so many Americans, really, probably.
Absolutely. But he, you know, again, except for the Hyde Amendment, he had pretty much come around on most pro-choice issues.
What did you think of his answers to you during the interview?
Right. So on Hyde in particular, his answer wasn't great. It was pretty confusing.
He seemed to be very confused about, you know, what the effect of Hyde was.
He does seem confused about it. And it's interesting because he's talked about this in other venues. This wasn't the first time. But basically, he's been making the case that as president, part of his platform is to expand Medicare and Medicaid access, mm-hmm. right? And his argument is, okay, well, because so many more people are going to be getting Medicaid, that's why the Hyde Amendment would no longer work, because so many women wouldn't be able to get insurance coverage for an abortion through those plans under Hyde. But the thing is, that argument doesn't make a lot of sense. Because, of course, it's already the case that there are millions of women around the country who can't get abortion access through Medicaid. So it's a little hard to understand why that policy would have been okay up until last summer.
Right.
But then it would become, you know, untenable.
He seemed to be arguing that in the past, there are these other places that women
particularly poor women, could go in order to get abortion access, places like Planned Parenthood. But under the Trump administration, many of those places have struggled with funding, and that now that those places are going away, it's more and more important that Medicaid exist as one way, one means of paying for abortion access. It was very confused, I agree with you, and I felt that he was tying himself up in knots to explain. More from our deliberations after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sexpionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in L.A., binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice.
Before too long, I would like to reinforce what Alex said. My expectations for him were profoundly shaped by the news coverage, which seems to have many, many valleys and rhetorical glitches. That didn't show up here. I mean, he seemed to be, and he did seem to get, campaigning is hard, but he just seemed to get sort of stronger and more emotional as he went on, even if he blew off some questions like Lawrence.
I mean, it's not just the news coverage, right? We've all seen him on the debate stage struggling to answer questions and fading as the debate goes on, and we've seen it more than once. And so, I mean, I agree, his performance today was very impressive. Does it completely set aside my concerns about his ability to run a strong race? No.
I guess it was not unimpressive, but I don't know if I'd call it impressive. he put aside my worst concerns about him,
right,
and he spoke fluidly for some time.
So that's a recurring theme.
But it still was not, as sharp as I would hope a presidential
candidate
would be.
I agree. I think there might be a little grading on a curve here. Like, our expectations were...
Outside of his reproductive health care answers, what were your impressions of Vice President Biden's interview with us? Any other surprises?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm being a little tough on the vice president here on this issue. But, you know, I did understand after that meeting why a lot of voters do connect with him. You know, he can be a very charismatic guy. He has a pretty amazing history and resume, and all of that came through in our meeting. You know, on the other hand, I think we also saw that he can be a bit rambling. He has, you know, his famous Joe Biden verbal tics, which can be sort of charming but also frustrating.
Yeah, I was particularly impressed with his answers on foreign policy. There were not a lot of candidates who articulated the sense of they've been in the room, that they've had to make decisions like that in the past, that they understood what the stakes were and that they knew how to act quickly. He also talked a little bit about the need to surround himself with good people, which is something that other candidates didn't really address. But I agree with you. I felt like a lot of his answers were pretty rambling. It's amazing to read the transcript, because in annotating those transcripts, we found ourselves having to explain that the vice president was being a little sloppy in his speech. And in the room, you knew exactly what he was talking about. But as you read the transcripts, there's often places where you have no idea what he's actually referring to.
Yeah, I agree with all of that.
I found interesting, just on the priority level, is, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but isn't he the only one who's really said this is all about beating Trump? This is about excising this guy from our politics.
Senator Harris
That was one of her refrains as well before she dropped out.
Well, right. I'm just talking about in our interviews.
He's not even
getting to the filibuster point of this. He's like, this
saving
is all about defeating Trump because four more years of him will be a disaster.
Right.
Yang did say
he's the only one who's
similar.
Made it the centerpiece of his campaign.
Which is maybe why he's not talking about policy.
That's come out in previous interviews, not as directly.
The vice president has really focused on beating Donald Trump as the center selling point for his campaign. Why aren't you satisfied with that message?
Sure. So I just happen to think that beating Trump isn't enough. Trump is a symptom of a bigger issue that I think has been happening in the Republican Party for a long time. And personally, as a voter, when I look at the slate of candidates, I want something to vote for.
It's such an uninspiring argument, just in general, that like there's this moment that feels very urgent and necessary, and it's just like, let's just like, you know, put a warm body that a lot of people can agree on there, like surround him with people. We've had a lot of people come in that chair with really interesting ideas, and I didn't hear actually like a lot of ideas. And so if you are running on this, I don't know, there's something to me as somebody who like has a lot of, you know,
who resonates
friends.
Most strongly with you, so you've seen so far?
I mean, I think there's, well, we can talk about that tomorrow, I think.
So that concludes our candidate interviews. You may have noticed we included a full transcript of the interview with Senator Cory Booker on the New York Times website. Mr. Booker dropped out of the race weeks before his episode was slated to air, but in the name of transparency, we wanted to share the transcripts of that interview for those still interested in what Mr. Booker had to say. We may be done with the candidates, but there's still a lot more to talk about. Tune in tomorrow to hear the board's final deliberations as members battle it out on behalf of their favorite candidates. You'll also hear our official choice for the 2020 Democratic primary. Thanks for listening.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.